Good morning, everybody, and welcome. On behalf of the Office of Community Engagement, we welcome you all to Thursday Morning Roundtable. This is our first session for the spring 22 semester. And before we begin, I would like to acknowledge with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral land Syracuse University now stands. It is my pleasure this morning to introduce the new executive director of community engagement at Syracuse University, Kate Slannery, who joined us in December. And Kate will now be moderating the Thursday morning roundtables. So Kate, welcome.
Good morning, everyone. It is my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much. Thursday morning roundtable is a weekly public forum hosted by Syracuse University Office of Community Engagement that features prominent newsmakers who discuss current events in Central New York and beyond. It is my pleasure to be your moderator today. I have the distinct pleasure to introduce our guests today. Their resumes and their bios have way too many accomplishments and lists of things they've excelled at for me to go on, but I will give a brief introduction. We have with us today, Anne Rooney, currently serves as the Deputy County Executive for Human Services for Onondaga County. In this role, she is responsible for directing, advising, and coordinating policy for managers and employees in the following departments: adult and long-term care services, children and family services, Office of Diversity and Inclusion, emergency communications 911, emergency management, health, probation, social services, economic security, and veteran services. Anne is a graduate of the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University with a master's degree in public administration. We are pleased to say that she is an adjunct professor here at the school. Today, she is joined with Daniel Wares. He is the Onondaga County Commissioner of Emergency Management, overseeing the department in addition to the Fire and Emergency Medical Services Bureau. In this role, he has helped lead the county through the COVID-19 pandemic, facilitated a major update to the comprehensive emergency management plan, and overseen significant updates to the Emergency Operations Center. Daniel earned a master's in public administration from the Maxwell School with a certificate of advanced study in national security studies and a bachelor's in public policy and administration from James Madison University. It is with great gratitude that we appreciate their time and expertise that they're going to share with us today on the topic of COVID-19 and the management of such. Dan, Anne, I'm going to give the floor to you.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Sid. Just before we get started, and you know, it's always fun to see who the participants are in a Zoom, and I see an awful lot of friendly faces, which is wonderful. I see the Honorable Peggy Chase, who is the chair of our health committee from the Onondaga County Legislature. And if all of you don't know, I'd just like to give you a little tidbit. During the high point of the pandemic last year, Peggy was one of our most relied upon volunteers at our vaccination clinic. I don't know how many people you actually vaccinated, Peggy, but I know it was an awful lot, and this community owes you a debt of gratitude. So thank you. And just before I go on, I also see Brian Fay from Syracuse Northeast Community Center. And when we say that planning for a pandemic and then executing takes everyone, it was one phone call that I made to Brian, who is the executive director of the Northeast Community Center, which is really a center of our refugee population in Syracuse. And Brian and I know each other a little bit. I think we know each other a lot more now after all of this. But with one request, he jumped on board to do testing, eventually vaccinations, and we could not be more grateful for all the work that he did. I also see Tracy DeGenova from Governor Hochul's office. Welcome, Tracy, and I hope you're enjoying your new job. And just as a side note, I see my sister. So everybody has to be nice in their questions because she'll get awfully mad at all of you if you don't treat us well. But I'm just teasing, obviously. So, Kate, if you could put up the first slide, I think that would be helpful. And then you don't have to look at us anymore. This is our topic, preparing, executing, and responding in a pandemic. And I think it is just a little, this is a little bit of the behind the scenes work that happened well before probably most of you had heard of COVID-19. And I thought it was a really interesting topic that Sid and Kate asked us in this, you know, the first TMR for this semester, because an awful lot went into this beforehand. And I also want to just point out a couple of things that having an emergency management department that has been so responsive, you know, thank you to Dan and his team. It's just been phenomenal, but I'm just going to go into a little bit and then turn it over to Dan. So next slide, please. The reason I wanted to make sure that the structure of Onondaga County was highlighted before we actually got into the more meat of this is part of what we do in preparation. So this is how we are organized, and organization matters, and it definitely has mattered during the course of preparing and executing during this pandemic. You can see leading the county is our county executive, Ryan McMahon, and we have three deputy county executives. Brian Donnelly is what is called the deputy county executive. I'm in the middle overseeing the human services. And Kate, thank you for reminding me of all those departments. And then Mary Beth Primo is the deputy county executive for physical services, your roads, your parks, cleanup of the lake, the zoo, facilities, a number of departments. Next slide, please. And why this is important. So back in 2014, we were very deliberate about looking at the way the county is organized. And as I said, it is very, very true. Organization matters. So if in particular, you look at emergency management and emergency communications, prior to 2014, those two departments were under the leadership of the Deputy County Executive for Physical Services. And when we looked at how we are organized, we asked ourselves, is it the most important that we're protecting, for instance, the infrastructure of emergency communications, your cell phone towers and all of that, and in emergency management, is it most important that we're making sure that we make sure that there's fire trucks and ambulances, or is what is most important, and obviously, you know, this is kind of a rhetorical question, it's the people that are being served through those departments. And so we went to the legislature and with legislative approval, changed the county charter and moved different departments around, separated some departments. But two of, you know, one of the biggest decisions was moving emergency management and E911 emergency communications under my portfolio and whomever that serves in that role. And just, we didn't know we were going to have to prepare for a pandemic. Obviously, none of us did, but we do know that we prepare for crisis. And looking back now to back to December of 2019, you can see that if the health department was under my, in my portfolio, and emergency management was under physical services under Mary Beth Primo, it would have just made for a little bit of disorganization that I don't think would have been beneficial for this community in handling the pandemic. So I just want to point out, and it's really important, I think, that we are looking at things like this and how important they are about structure matters. And it, I think it was also helpful for the county executive in his decision-making that we had a structure where those who are charged with responding to the pandemic, basically we're all in the same place. So that's my pitch about organization and public administration and how important it is. But now I'm going to turn it over to Dan Weirs. Dan has been, what year? 2015?
Yes.
Dan has been our Commissioner of Emergency Management since 2015. I'm proud to say that I recommended his hire to the then County Executive Joni Mahoney and was approved by the legislature. Dan is extremely impressive as an emergency management commissioner. He takes all things into consideration. He has had great training since I think he's about 12 years old in this field. And we as a team have worked very closely. Before I turn it over to him, I'm going to point out one more thing. Dan came to me in December of 2019. You know, we have our weekly, once every 2 week meetings at that point. It got to a point where we're having meetings about every hour. But he came to me in December of 2019 and said, we really need to take a look at this thing that's happening over in Asia. He said, I really think we need to activate some of our preparedness initiatives, get people in a room. And at first I was, you know, I guess I was listening. But sometimes you ask yourself, is he overreacting? But a couple times he came to me and I said, yeah, let's get people together. And so in January, you know, we went through the holidays, and then in January of 2020, we pulled a massive group of people that you will see from the next slide together to start talking about this. So that all was predated when, you know, March 15th happened and we basically closed everything down. So that gives you a sense of what we were doing. And now I'm going to turn it over to Dan. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Ann. So what I'm going to do really quickly this morning is kind of talk a little bit about what we do generally, and then obviously tie it all back into the pandemic and then how that played out, and a little bit more specifics about the things that we did in preparedness and how well they played out for us during the pandemic. You can jump to the next slide, please. So Ann talked about some of the preparedness stuff we do. In its most basic sense, our charge under the county charter is really to make sure that the county's prepared for all types of incidents, all hazards that could potentially impact us here. One of the ways that we do that is we have an emergency preparedness committee that looks at things from the county level. Typically, we will not get engaged in something until it exceeds the capability or the capacity of a jurisdiction or agency or a specific discipline where they start needing additional resources from other disciplines. So one way that we do that is with this committee. The way that these groups are selected to be on this committee is based on the emergency support functions outlined in the National Incident Management System. All of these players, have a big role, a lot of resources, a lot of impact, or have direct responsibility for certain hazards that happen in throughout the community. So this group meets on a regular basis, about every other month, and then obviously has a lot of different things going on in it. This is the initial group that Ann mentioned that we brought together in January of 2020. The years are starting to muddle together a little bit. There were some others that kind of came. So it doesn't look like that big of a group. I think our first meeting was 35 to 40 people by the time we brought in multiple people for these agencies and some ancillary other agencies that have very close tie into these major functions. You can jump forward, please. So with that, I think that's also kind of day to day. It's important to understand that that group isn't really what's driving our entire preparedness efforts. We rely on another number of other committees that we sit on or we have participation in, or they maybe come to our thing. So just kind of to highlight a few of them, we have a disaster preparedness committee that's a much larger community meeting that allows other agencies in, and it's a much more open meeting. To meet and greet and to learn faces. And so we're not, learning who people are at the time of an incident, to understand their capabilities and how they might be able to help us respond to an incident. The Human Needs Task Force, I'm just going to touch on that quickly because I'll talk about it more later. That committee has been meeting for, I think we started it back up around 2016. Their sole mission is how we are going to provide food, water, shelter, transportation, and mental health to the community if we need to, in some type of large-scale incident. I'll talk specifics later. With that, another core advisory group is a group of individuals with disabilities who we talk about plans and we get their feedback and their buy-in and recommendations to make sure we're accounting for those different needs within the community and within our plans, and to make sure we're thinking about that in advance. The other ones are primarily our law enforcement, public safety, and I'll talk about them later. And another big one here that really played out that we've got a great relationship with the Long-Term Care Executive Council. Obviously, the pandemic had a large impact on the nursing homes. We had a lot of communication through them, and to be able to have a one-stop shop to call the executive director of that council and reach out to all of the nursing homes was really beneficial. I mean, not only during the pandemic, but then again, recently with the Park Rose evacuation, they're a great partner that we have. Then you can jump to the next slide, please. So I think another important thing with our community is understand like the scope of the resources that are here and the things that we do on a regular basis. A big mission of what ours is really relationship building with all these organizations so we can understand what their capabilities and capacities and again, have contacts, know who to reach out to when we need them, you know what they can provide, and also vice versa. So if we know that National Grid is potentially going to have a problem with their infrastructure, if they're seeing something that might be a little funny with weather, you know, they know who to call here and have that conversation and give us some awareness if it's appropriate. So we work with these 100 public safety agencies, the towns and the village and the city on a regular basis. We communicate with a lot of them directly, whether through the county executive's office or through us on different things as part of our pandemic response. And also some of our advanced planning and some of our big partners, our infrastructure owners, were really helpful in different parts as well. Next slide, please. So this is a picture of our emergency operations center. So a lot of what we do is really capability building. We look at what hazards might impact the community. We identify, you know, what kind of capabilities we need to build as part of our preparedness efforts in order then to be able to respond. So I'm really only going to talk about the ones that are bolded, because those are the ones that are were most used during the pandemic. I'm going to start with public alert and warning communication. That, you know, that's really how, you know, we can do reverse notifications from 911. That's how we do press conferences. That's how we do other things. I think this has been one of the really great strengths of the county and, you know, the willingness of the county executive and his desire to make sure we're providing, you know, transparent, consistent, and very frequent communication to the community. Even though it doesn't say that in that title, these are kind of the federal terms, but that's really where this falls, and, you know, the public affairs and public, you know, information sharing. I think that's one of the areas that we did really well as a community, and I've heard that from places, you know, around the state where they've heard it, or some of my peers in other areas. Human needs, I kind of touched on this more. So this is one of the areas that early on in the pandemic, when things were around much more of a kind of a shutdown and a lockdown, and people who were most at risk and the elderly were asked to stay home, we knew that we were going to have to provide those people with meals. And as part of our planning effort, we had planned to provide congregate meals at shelters and other things. And in this situation, we knew that that wasn't going to work. So a lot of what we do is we do our deliberate planning in advance of an emergency, and then we utilize the Emergency Operations Center knowing that those plans aren't always going to be accurate. And we're gonna have to modify those plans on the fly to meet the situation. And that's just the reality. We're never gonna get those plans 100%. And that's how, you know, we know that going into this. So we immediately, you know, tapped into the human needs group, who typically we would provide, you know, meal delivery to, you know, just the people who are homebound. You know, it's a very small percentage of who we might provide versus like a Labor Day storm type incident. And in this case, it went 100% meal delivery. It went 100%, you know, to that door, utilizing some of the partners that already exist. And that's how we do that. We augment the capability that already existed in the community. So we tap into, you know, the Red Cross. We tap into the Syracuse, we tap into the food bank, we tap into those other organizations. And then, and kind of tying this back to the beginning with all of our partners, these aren't things that we do alone. We had DOT drivers delivering meals. We had WEP, Water Environment Protection employees delivering meals. And on a future slide, you'll see we were just shy of 400,000 meals that were delivered to people's doors in the first few months of the pandemic. Mass prophylaxis and vaccination, and I talked about legislative chase and a big part of that. And then, you know, and what we do, that's something that we build with the health department. We don't own this capability necessarily, but we support them logistically. And it's one of the things that we do, and we executed with them during the pandemic in support of that. At one time, we were doing about 3,500 vaccines a day in one location. And that was in the early stages of that. And that's really all based on that relationship and the planning, and then the exercising of that, you know, in advance of the pandemic. So we know what it is. We can work out some of those kinks, and then we still have to go through those, you know, at the time. Resource management's a big one. I'm going to talk about that later. I'll kind of skip over that. That's really how we, you know, get resources into the community, push resources out into the community. I say into the community, like into the county, and then we push them actually down into, you know, down to the ground level where they're needed in response to something. And let's see, I gotta just move my picture, I see a slide. the last couple here, incident management, coordination, emergency operations center, those really go together. So we activated the emergency operations center for the longest known activation in the county's history. We had 88 straight days where we were activated, about 12 to 14 hours at a time. And really, this was the place that took a lot of those deliberate plans and switched those over and made them, you know, react the way they did. If people remember when we first started testing in the community, it was supposed to be a walk up to the, or drive into the Syracuse Community Health Center, and you were going to walk in and be tested. Within about 4 hours, we knew that wasn't going to happen, and we had to change our model and go to a drive-through model. And it was the Emergency Operations Center, the people working there, that really made that happen in a 24 to 48 hour change. And that was a really big change with the weather in early March and other things. It wasn't as simple as just, you know, lining the cars up. Those were the folks that really made that happen. We go to the next slide, please. So some of the specific things that that we worked on throughout the pandemic, just to give people an idea, hospital surge planning. This is early on when we saw New York City and other places start to, you know, potentially exceed their capacity of their hospital and have to have overflow. This was, again, where we reached out to one of our partners, Syracuse University, who graciously stepped up and, you know, offered up the Manly Fieldhouse as a potential location for that. We had a plan. We came in. We had vendors on site. We knew, you know, had a general idea of how we would open up something like that if we had to. Luckily, we never had to, but thanks to, like, so the university and other players who really just kind of stepped up and were willing to do whatever needed, we felt that if we had to do it, we would be able to pull it off. We'd have some obstacles to overcome when we did it, but we would, you know, we had a plan ready to execute if necessary. Some of the other key things we did, you know, mass fatality planning, I think this is something nobody typically wants to talk about or think about, but we obviously know that there is a huge devastation to the community and in the country as far as loss of life. And we wanted to make sure that, you know, if our hospitals and if our infrastructure locally couldn't accommodate that, we had a plan to make sure that people were cared for in the appropriate way and the way that they deserved. Again, fortunately, we didn't have to fully implement this plan. That's something that we really, you know, leaned on heavily early on to make sure that if it got as bad as was projected at times, that we are ready to react to that and take care of people appropriately. You know, some of the other things, sheltering. We always talked about sheltering as far as, you know, we're gonna, you know, people are out of their house, people, you know, lose their, you know, for water or storm damage or something. Never really planned on, you know, providing, you know, daycare and essential, or daycare for essential workers and hotels for essential workers so that they could continue their job. So these are all kind of modifications on a plan that we had, you know, that we had then kind of shift that focus of people who are impacted by, you know, their home not being habitable to how we are going to, you know, put these people in a hotel to get some respite, to get some, you know, be away from their family if they've been exposed and be able to continue to serve the community. Talk a little bit about community needs. One of our big things early on was really, you know, how we, you know, supported the community and different things that we did and utilize those partners. 211 was a great partner for information and collecting information back, and, you know, even taking registrations for vaccine and testing appointments for people who maybe didn't have access to the internet, or people who just weren't comfortable doing it, or people who couldn't type fast enough. It was like getting Super Bowl tickets at one point, getting some of these appointments. So we were able to work with them and you know, carve out some appointments to allow some of those people to get better access to the services. I talked about the meals already. Again, this was a tremendous partnership from DOT to the community organizations. You know, something we never planned on doing was delivering just shy of 300,000 meals throughout the community. Related to that, a lot of times while we were doing that meal delivery, we're also providing some of those people their hygiene needs, personal hygiene and their home hygiene, to make sure that, you know, they could continue to live comfortably in their house while they were essentially being asked not to go to the store to protect themselves from catching COVID, you know, and then obviously protecting their community and stuff too. So mental health, you know, there's 211, again, great partner with that to try to help people get into some mental health. That was something we recognized really as the potential. You know, we saw that, we monitored 911 calls, we monitored different data to see, you know, what the trends were. And it was something early we saw that a potential impact. So we tapped, you know, 211 and some other organizations to be able to flex up if necessary and be willing to take, you know, additional phone calls than they normally would to maybe just have that conversation with somebody, you know, about their mental health needs. And, you know, maybe that's all they needed was one conversation to understand that, you know, what they were feeling was okay and normal and consistent with what other people were feeling. But it was one of those areas that we didn't want to forget to make sure people could make it through the pandemic. Next slide, please. And I'm going to go faster this time, so we're getting close to the question and answer. there's just so much to cover when you sit back and start talking about it. It's amazing, you know, kind of the stuff that we pulled off over 2 years. Testing. We did a number of testing things. Initially, testing started with us was to keep the emergency departments open. We did not want everybody going to the hospitals to be tested because they thought they might have COVID. So the county partnered with, you know, all the hospital sent staff, the Syracuse Community Health Center. We set up that first drive-through testing site early on in the pandemic, actually before we had a case here locally. That was originally all designed to keep pressure off the hospital so that they could continue to function and not only treat people who are impacted by the pandemic, but everything else that happens day to day. Heart attacks don't stop, car crashes don't stop. You know, all of that stuff continues within the community. So we have to look at it beyond the pandemic and to figure out and look at what the impacts are globally. That transition to mobile testing, we popped up. I wish I had the numbers of how many we did. We could go back and get them, but we popped up test sites all throughout the county, different location every single day that allow people to get tested in their community and to make it more readily available to them. We went into senior living facilities and independent assisted living and independent senior living facilities early on and offered testing to all their residents and staff. That was a great partnership with Essentia that made that happen. And then one of the biggest takes, and there's a number here at the end here, but the testing of the school-based testing, when we got put into orange and yellow zones, the amount of effort that went in to keep those kids in school and to make sure we were hitting that 10, 15, 20% threshold, whatever it might've been, I think Ann's gonna convulse here a little bit about it. at some days we had 46 teams out in the community doing testing. Sometimes those teams went to more than one school a day to keep those kids in school. And that was all coordinated by here. It wasn't done here. It wasn't done by our people, but it was all coordinated by here to make sure they had this the plan, the resources, the schedule to know where they're going. And that was a huge undertaking that took quite a bit of time. PPE distribution, I don't think anyone knew what PPE was before the pandemic, personal protective equipment. And I'll talk about this later, but we distributed it to about 1,000 agencies throughout the county. Doctor's offices, first response agencies, daycares, dentists, law enforcement, schools, in-home care, local governments, and really anybody that needed it. We knew early on that it was going to become a strain. And one of my favorite things about COVID, my funny things about the early days of COVID, I was asked, how much money do you need to get started on this PPE? I said, I don't know, give me 100,000. We're going to get started with 100,000. That lasted a couple of days. It really, you know, the county just had a great commitment to keep bringing in that PPE and keep distributing. Yeah, I think we're roughly 6 million ended up being in PPE that was procured by the county and distributed. And I'll show you some numbers in another slide to give you a scope of that. Again, one of those things that we never planned on giving dentists and doctor's office PPE. You know, they're medical providers. They get it themselves. They know how to get it. We learned really quickly how to get medical supplies. Emergency Operations Center, I won't talk, we talked about that already, 88 days. One of the other big things that we had a huge deal with was homeless shelters. What do we do if a homeless shelter was impacted by COVID and the people had to quarantine? So we had a combination of different things going where, you know, people who were isolated and became positive would be put in hotels, and people who were close proximity may also be put in a hotel for temporary quarantine. We bought an ambulance to transport people if necessary. A used ambulance, a vehicle, it's not necessarily, it doesn't treat people. But, you know, we had to be prepared if we can't get someone who is positive out of that location and they can't take Uber, they can't take Lyft. How do we get that person to a safe location to try to limit the spread of COVID? A lot of the other things is that if we did have an outbreak in these shelters, what do we do with the 100 or 200 people that spend every night in that location? So we worked with social services and the state and some other organizations, the YMCA, to if we have to shut down a shelter, where do we provide these people, you know, with accommodations overnight where they can still be safe and in an appropriate climate? And all of those plans were done behind the scenes. Again, we never had to do it. Our other, you know, mitigation strategies worked to limit the spread in those locations. But it was another one of those things that if we didn't have it and we needed it, we would have been in a lot of trouble. The last one here, vaccinations. I talked about that went on. We started just around Christmas of 2020. Yeah. And I said at our peak, we were doing, you know, 3,000, 3,500 a day. that was usually when it was a first dose, second dose. I think when we were doing one dose at a time, 1,600 to 2,000, I think a day was about our max. That obviously is continuing to ongoing and, you know, still getting out into the community. And that's another thing that we did in the community to make sure that people had access to the vaccination is went to community organizations and churches and community centers and really worked with the health department to go a different location almost every day for a while to make sure that was available. Syracuse Housing Authority, different places are jumping to mind now, make sure that people. We also worked with Essentia there to do in-home vaccination as well. And they've done, you know, thousands of in-home vaccines for people who could not get out and get the vaccine on their own. So, and a lot of that kind of goes back to our preparedness. You know, it was a lot like the testing model. You know, we, with the Health Department Emergency Manager, we train on this. We look at this ahead of time, kind of what is the basic concept and model that needs to be implemented. And then we adapt it to the specifics. And that's what we did here. So the process of getting a test and being vaccinated were almost identical. From our perspective, it was just a different, you know, medical procedure on the far end of it that really changed. And we can jump to the next slide. Yep, there's a couple more of them. There's a couple numbers I think are good for people to see. This is some of the big ticket items, not dollar figure, but big items that we pushed out that were in high demand throughout the pandemic. And, you know, surgical masks, you know, almost a million of them. You can look at the numbers. I won't read them all. so really, we're looking up over, you know, 2 million pieces of PPE out into the community, roughly $6 million worth that was all provided to these locations so that they could continue to function and meet the needs of their, you know, their clients or the people that they serve. And this is, you know, ongoing a very tiny bit still to make sure that people are supported. And we've seen different peaks throughout this process. You know, gloves at one point were very hard to see. Hard to get in the market, and we had already done that. Last slide, just kind of some testing stats. So people, and these are only tests for that the county had a direct hand in. This is actually a vaccination site, but I think it was kind of a cool picture where we went out in the community to drive through vaccination at Shopping Town Mall. But the testing side, this is only tests that the county had a direct hand in. 135,000 plus asymptomatic tests. This is the school-based testing. This is the asymptomatic testing we're doing now. So people can get tested to go to the nursing home or go to grandma's house or go, you know, wherever they want to go and feel a little bit safer about that. Recently, we've distributed just shy of 105,000 over-the-counter tests to communities. And so people have direct access to the antigen test in their home. And then 40,000 symptomatic tests. That's just at the regional market that we did kind of last winter of symptomatic tests. So this has nothing to do with what the hospitals have done or other private care people have tested. These are just some of the numbers that we had. So probably a little too long, but in a quick nutshell, that's really kind of some of the big high level stuff that we did from the county during the pandemic. And we are happy to take questions.
Thank you, Dan. And the scope of the area of responsibility has been just stunning to really think about the number of components that have to be taken into consideration by the county to respond. One of the questions that came in talked about, you mentioned that in January of 2020, you started planning before the March 15th shutdown. What kind of, were you in partnership with hospitals and what other organizations at that time came to the table early and helped to respond and to coordinate your response?
Yeah, absolutely. Hospitals are a big player. We actually had some off conversations with them in advance of it too. And then we really used that County Emergency Preparedness Committee with it. So it was law enforcement, it was EMS, it was infrastructure partners, because they need to understand, you know, they need to make sure their infrastructure is going to continue to function, need to understand what was happening. It was the hospitals, fire, EMS, you know, other municipalities, the schools were very early on as well through the county executive's office to make sure that they were continuing to stay in that. And we took feedback from all of them, and we stayed in constant communication, especially with the hospitals for a while. You know, and had conversations with certain people in the county executive's office did. And then we had other conversations with other areas of the hospital on a daily basis as we kind of progressed through this to monitor how things were going.
Excellent. Thank you. So there's a question here asking you to expand on mental health needs and what has that done in the process over the last 2 years, and how has the county altered its response from sort of daily business to what the pandemic has sort of changed those types of interventions?
We realized early on, as everyone did, the isolation factor that the pandemic caused was going to have really potentially detrimental effects on the community. Sadly, we could see the effects from opioid use, that the number of deaths from overdose honestly skyrocketed during the pandemic. But people were struggling. I mean, people we worked with, we came to work every day and we could see the struggle. But what we did was connect with 211, which is the community resource. And then they were able, through contracting with the county, to engage various mental health community resources. So we were able to set up for people who were struggling to set up mental health counseling, telehealth appointments through that. And I think telehealth became a very celebrated thing during the pandemic, not just for physical health, but also for mental health. And that has continued. The other, you know, thing that we could see, not only for seniors isolated in their homes, but for, you know, our youngest members of our community being at home was really, really problematic. And in as Dan said, I get my years mixed up as well. But last spring, you know, we were seeing the impact of this, and the county executive made a decision to of resources of $5.5 million for school-based mental health on top of our already $13 million investment in this area. And that was to really expand out to suburban school districts to have that ability to have it really be school-based. Because one thing we know, we also don't want to contribute to learning loss. And so if a child isn't in school because they are going outside for whether it's a doctor's appointment or an appointment for mental health services, there's lost instruction there. So by bringing the services into the school, we minimize that. That time of lost instruction. So this has been a really deliberate effort. We had a whole team working on that mental health component. Like Dan said, we had people running all over delivering food and all that, but they were also able to do check-ins with people and really see the state of where people were and make referrals, honestly, if necessary. And that was happening on a daily basis. So that was a really big component of what we felt was our one of our most important responsibilities through the pandemic.
Thank you. That was very helpful and informative. Can you please share a little bit about how you worked with FEMA during the pandemic?
Yeah, so a lot of the FEMA, there's a sense that typically this is not just pandemic related, it's general that FEMA comes in with these armies of people to support areas after an incident. A lot of what FEMA does really is financial. So you know, we worked on throughout the process to you know kind of what we were doing and what was going to be reimbursable and not reimbursable. And a lot of it was you know kind of applying for that assistance. They have helped in other parts kind of later on in the pandemic as it's been some of the problems with the hospital that we've had with the staffing, other things, with bringing in federal teams or bringing in contracts with the National Ambulance Contract to support us locally. So typically, you know, they're not coming with an army of people, they're coming with a checkbook and a few people to help coordinate. And in this case, they sent some teams to provide some support to our local infrastructure.
Excellent. Thank you. Can you please share with us a little bit about lessons learned and what you might do differently, having the privilege of hindsight, looking back? How would you handle the crisis differently, or what areas would you prepare alternatively?
I would say some of the 30,000 foot lessons learned. Certainly we would have had the access to a depot for all of the PPE that we had to distribute, because at the beginning we had to basically take over the On Center for all of this stuff. Other lessons learned is, and I have to say, and kudos to Dan, since he arrived, he really re-energized a lot of those committees that you saw at the beginning of his presentation. And one that we have, I think, came to the fore recently was the disability community and making sure that we have constant communication, like we do as much as we have with our, you know, public safety organizations, to make sure that we're in constant connection with them. The other, I think, and I think we all now take the scope of emergency management a little more seriously than we did before. You know, you never knew when the big one was going to come. Well, this was bigger than anybody could have ever anticipated. So a lot of it was on the fly, but we did have good plans in place. And so what we have also learned as a result of this on our local level for our organization, and I encourage all of you who are the heads of different organizations, we are going to go through a mass departmental continuity planning process in the next year to year and a half. And if your organizations haven't done that, I certainly would encourage it, because everybody closing down and having to send employees home on the fly, and when are they coming back, and how are we going to continue this operation? Being really planful about continuity of operations is something that's a huge lesson learned for us.
We had great plans. We had a really good foundation. The one thing I wish we had done a little bit more, and if we were on our, we actually canceled the EOC exercise in March of 2020. I wish we had a little bit more training and exercise on some of those plans to kind of broaden the knowledge base of it. I think everything overall worked really well, but that next step would have made it work that much better, I think. And like I said, we were doing that. We were in the process, and we canceled an exercise because the EOC was activated for real.
Thank you. I mean, I think Anne started this presentation talking about the need for structure and planning and continuity and communication. And clearly that has continued to be an important factor going forward. Someone asked, if there's a positive that came out of COVID, could you point to anything that is a positive as a result?
Yeah, and my best friend, Sydney Johnson, is on this. And we became best friends. We were already friendly before the pandemic, but since then, I think the communication amongst everyone who is going to play a role in a potential disaster, these relationships are now so well developed, and there was so much dependence on one another. And now what's come out of this is confidence in one another. That if this were anything like this were to happen again, or God forbid, you know, we go into next fall, and I think this is what we're probably all fearful of, we're going to have a nice respite. We're taking the masks off. You know, Dan and I have our masks off today because of what Governor Hochul said yesterday. I think we're all happy that things might get a little normalized, but should things turn south next fall, if you will, we know that all these partners are ready to go. And that is definitely a positive that came out of, for our community, a definite positive that came out of this pandemic.
Thank you. Yes, the importance of relationships and communication in our community. We always knew it was important, but to your point, I think it's become illustrated in a way that is indelible for us going forward. Can you tell us a little bit about kids in school? You alluded to the fact of keeping kids in school. Is there planning going forward, to your point about if there is an uptick in the fall? How? Because I know that's a priority, right? For a variety of reasons, our children most importantly, and our community at whole. But could you share a little bit with what's being planned to keep our kids in school?
Yeah, I think barring complete upturn in numbers, there are absolutely no plans to close school again. The unintended consequences of that for children and, you know, learning loss. And I think there's going to be study after study of children who came out of the pandemic and, you know, their trajectory. I mean, as working in this field for a long time, I can anticipate that there's going to be a lot of work done in that area. So things that we will continue to do, for instance, we have an ongoing asymptomatic testing program in all schools, and that we have a team from our health department that works with schools every, you know, we're testing over 4,000 children voluntarily a week and looking at upticks in cases. So, you know, all the school districts also got PPE money from, got ARPA money from the federal government. We have all of our acronyms mixed up. But they're using that for prevention purposes. A lot of filtration systems are being purchased, you know, because that was one thing we heard. Schools are old infrastructure in a lot of cases to make sure that that is in existence. All of the things, I can't tell you how closely we worked with all of the school districts during the pandemic. The county doesn't have purview over schools. You know, every district has their own school. We were on weekly calls with superintendents about guidance, and Dr. Gupta was instrumental in this in providing guidance about how to stay open safely. So we will continue that planning without any anticipation of closing schools again.
Excellent, thank you. There's a question here. What was the role or relationship with the area guard and reserves, those types of assets? Were you able to utilize those, and if so, how?
Yeah, they really come in after, you know, they came in like kind of at the tail end, and they were utilized a lot more downstate. So typically, even though they're locally and we have relationships with them, we still can't call them directly and ask them to come support us. So that all is a part of the system that we use, is we still have to call Albany and request those assets based on what, you know, what kind of mission we want to accomplish. And then, you know, the state emergency management will decide, you know, what assets are available to stay and how that might pay, how might be able to support us. So the activation of the guard and to send them into a local community is a governor decision. So in this case, they did help in some of the hospitals, and they helped downstate with some of those field hospitals. We fully expect that if we had to go to a field hospital, we would have certainly requested the guard for that support. So we said, we know them, we talk to them, but we, you know, and if something were immediate, I think they would come and help and maybe ask for permission later. But in this case, you know, we don't have that direct connection to them.
Okay, thank you. There's a question regarding what would you ask of community members, citizens, to do differently going forward than maybe we did in our response as community members? How could we partner more effectively to accomplish our larger community goals?
I think from the beginning, and Dan alluded to it a little bit, the county executives almost daily, sometimes we had two press conferences a day, but our community responded in such a way that, you know, we didn't see a lot of the issues that were going on in other parts of the country. We haven't seen mass protests about masking. We haven't, you know, if there was one thing, I think there was a really concerted effort about the efficacy of the vaccine. There has been an ongoing attempted outreach to get into pockets where the vaccination numbers weren't that great. But I think we should celebrate what this community has done to address this pandemic. Everyone was attentive. They responded. I mean, we have had very few complaints of, you know, here and there we'll have complaints about, you know, nobody in Wegmans is wearing their mask. You know, we get very few of those. And, you know, you read about it in the national press, but I don't know if any of you feel differently. But, you know, and I'll turn it back to Syracuse University. They had it the one of the first football games. There was, you know, complaints about people not masking. And that was at a time when we didn't have a high number of cases. But within Syracuse University responded, and then the community responded. And I don't think we heard any other complaints after that first game with that. So I think it's something that we should actually celebrate, is this community's response. I was on a call yesterday and looking to recruit somebody from out of town, and they were talking about people, and they said, one of the commenters, and I think it was very, very true, said, you know, we're a community that kind of is, we're rational, we're well-thinking, we respond. And I think that was very reflected during in the height of the pandemic, people didn't lose their marbles. And I think that was really, really indicative of the type of community that we live in.
Thank you. Yes, lots to be celebrated with the strengths of our community. The county executive became the daily face and guide for the community to hear and receive updates, as you referenced. Can you share the planning for the press conferences going forward? It was so valuable to the community. Is there a plan to continue those?
Dan and I are chuckling because if you were to go into my office, and on my table across from my desk is two stacks this high of all of his notes from every press conference. And the way that process, it was just kind of not something you ever actually planned for. But if we go back to that structure slide that we showed at the beginning, the health department and emergency management you know, they report up through me. And so on a daily basis, especially during the height of it, there will be myself, the county executive, emergency management, Dan Weirs, and Dr. Indu Gupta, our health commissioner, meeting twice a day. But what came out of that was the production of his daily press conference notes, and I had to do it. And so to this day, yesterday, when he was out in Marcellus, it is still one of the tasks that you could say you could turn it over into the hands of your communications director, but the information was so granular that he was delivering that we didn't want to risk that it was going to get lost in that translation. So he and I think we had a little bit of a hand in glove relationship through this whole thing, and his trust in us, you know, our team, we can't thank him enough, because if we advised him, no, please don't say that at this point, that is not a good idea, we are not ready, he listened. And that was invaluable to us in a planning and execution process.
Thank you. Well, in the interest of time, I can't thank you both enough. Dan, and this has been so informative, and you know, you think you know about something, and then you realize, to your point, the scope, right, of the intersection of all of our community organizations, agencies, values coming together. So I just want to thank you so much for your time, and you've done such an admirable job. I just am so impressed. And on behalf, I'd like to thank our audience for attending today on this important topic. We're really privileged to be back together communicating, and someday we will be in person again soon. But for right now, for continued caution, we're going to stay at in a video model. But for all those who could not attend Thursday's morning roundtable, if you know people who would be interested in this presentation, it is recorded and available for viewing at the Office of Community Engagement webpage. The forums are recorded through a partnership also with WCNY Radio, and the audio versions can be found on WCNY's Thursday morning roundtable webpage also. So I just want to thank you all so much. Sydney, do you want to say anything before we close today?
Just want to say welcome back. Happy to have everyone with us, and look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day. Stay warm and safe. Thank you.